Cloudcast Media presents, from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina, this is the Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to the Cloudcast. First sort of official show of 2015 where both Aaron and I are on. And Aaron, welcome back.
I know. And Raleigh, you know, the massive studios here, we're about to close down. We might get half an inch of sleet tonight, and all of Raleigh is in chaos right now.
I'm up in Cambridge amongst apparently all these really smart MIT people, and they can't figure out how to make it warm either. So you're cold. I'm freezing.
You probably have like a foot of snow, and it's no big deal, and we have half an inch, and it's
missed. Yeah. So a couple of things before we get to our guest, because this is a guest we've wanted to have on for a very long time. So two things real quick. First and foremost, folks are going to realize we didn't have a sponsor on today's show, as we have for a very long time, and there's a reason for that. The sponsor who's been probably our primary sponsor for a long time, Momentum SI, really good guys, systems integrators, DevOps, automation, lots of cool stuff, got acquired by VMware. And So congratulations to Jeff and all the gang at Momentum. Hopefully we get to do some stuff with them, but congratulations to them.
Absolutely.
And the second thing is, thank you very much to a whole bunch of folks who've been helping us with the Krispy Kreme challenge. So this last week, we got a bunch of very, very nice donations. Our number is up. We're still a little behind where we want to be, about a month out from the run. But thank you to those folks. Very, very generous. And again, everything always goes to the kids at the NC Children's Hospital. So so that's very cool. It's a good positive note for 2015 to get started on.
And are you running up there in Massachusetts?
I am running up here, so I'll be ready to go. I'll be ready to go, although, you know, I'm getting fatter as the years go along, so who knows what's going to happen. Anyways, why don't we jump to our guest? You want to introduce our guest? Because, when we made the list, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, he was on our list of people that we never thought we would get, but we ran into him one time at a bar, and he said, "Hey, I listen to you guys."
Yeah, exactly. So Adrian Kakaroff, how are you doing, Adrian?
I'm doing fine. It's lovely and warm here in Menlo Park. I actually had the air conditioning on the car as I was driving around today.
And really, so currently partner at Battery Ventures. But we've, of course, been following you and we've been stalking you for a number of years now, based off of course, the history at Netflix and kind of the rise of microservices, which is part of definitely what we're going to talk about tonight. So yes, mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you very much for this. This is, a nice big check mark on our guest list that we get to check off now, finally.
So let me start this because, like I said, we've been kind of bantering with Adrian about trying to get him on the show. And he said, "Yeah, I have some time. I was listening to your 2014 things. I have some things to talk to you guys about." So why don't we start there? Because I'm guessing it's you guys got some things completely wrong. Or where were we way off from 2014 that we may have some things to discuss?
I don't think you actually. It was more like you were touching on some subjects that I've been thinking about and wanted to go a bit deeper on. So I can't remember exactly what your 2014 things were, but they all seemed reasonable.
I'm breathing a sigh of relief right now.
Yeah, I wasn't basically saying you got it all wrong. It was more that I was going, but click in and go down another level deeper on what's going on there, because there's some patterns that have been emerging in the industry, and now I'm in my new role for the last year. I've been at Battery Ventures for 1 year now. And just seeing the kind of things that are going on, so you sort of start to see the patterns and you start to distill what might be happening in the industry.
So what would those – let's just throw one or two of them out there. What are those that you're starting to see?
Yeah, I brought up the old list. You want me to read some of them off and see what strikes a
– Well, you'd mentioned to us kind of this idea of sort of a dev's view of things versus an ops view of things, and people trying to solve problems. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's something that sort of crystallized gradually. I've spent time in both camps, and I've been and then with DevOps, the camps are sort of getting mashed together in some way. But in a lot of cases, what you see is companies that are very dev-focused, that's their orientation. And yeah, they have some ops people, or they're very ops focused. And yes, they have some dev people. So it's kind of a who's on top thing, to some extent. And you see companies and users in that like that. And then you see companies trying to sell into that space and trying to decide, who are you really selling to? So you see a lot of companies going into the enterprise space, and they're saying, well, are you selling to the developers, or are you selling to the ops, the CIO, the ops people? And it's a very different approach. And you get, you have to build the product in different ways, and you're aiming at different spaces, and you end up with a very different kind of approach to the market. And that's where I think there's some interesting differences to look at.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I think, one of the things I find that's kind of weird is, a lot of folks will look at like an Amazon, and they'll go, okay, I think I understand the experience. And they'll kind of at a high level say, well, it's self-service, and it's on demand. And, you know, I can either get infrastructure, or I can get certain application types of services. And they kind of forget, and IT people want to translate that back and say, well, I could build that internally and call that a private cloud. But, you've always been very adamant to sort of say, well, that model works best for developers who are saying, let IT get out of the way. What do you find in terms of, like, give us an example of a company. You're obviously looking at lots of companies that you would say kind of has a dev view more so than, maybe a different example of a company that you think maybe has an ops view or a technology that might be confused a lot.
A couple of examples. One is I was at Netflix for 7 years, but before that I was at eBay for about 2 or 3 years. And eBay had it's basically a retailer with a technology division that was very operationally focused. The developers worked in teams. It was very, at the time I was there, it was sort of a factory approach. There was a machine that was churning out changes to the website, and there was a very strong platform operation around that. And it scaled, and there were a number of good things about it. We learned a lot. But when I went to Netflix, it was almost exactly the same technology stack. It was sort of, Java and Tomcat and arrays of Linux machines and whatever, and database backend. So very similar sort of 2 week cycle for releases to the site, things like that. That was the way Netflix was doing the DVD site back in 2007. The thing about Netflix, though, is that the founder and the management team are really all developers. Reed Hastings wrote Purify back in the 90s. That was his first company. Ended up part of Rational, that was part of IBM. So he's got a very developer-oriented view, and a lot of the other management too do too. So operations was always this thing that they never quite could get. It didn't really have a lot of sort of love within Netflix, really. And they never really managed to automate the things they were doing. They were always firefighting and building these one-off snowflakey kind of machines. But that was okay, because Netflix at that time ran on about 50 or 100 machines total. That was all you needed to run the DVD site. Big Oracle backend, like 25 web servers, something like that. And as we went to the sort of cloud transformation that happened around 2009, 2010, the ops team were saying, no, this cloud thing's not going to work. So eventually just told them to say, well, you go off and keep running the data center stuff, and we'll figure out how to run the cloud. So basically, the team that went and figured out how to use AWS was purely a developer team. And we built an interface into AWS that was sort of a set of APIs and layers of platform on top of that. So that was my kind of sort of transformational sort of change within Netflix that I think was interesting, because we basically turned it into this DevOps approach, but starting from the developer side of things, or just automating all the ops using developers to do it. And you see some other people in the DevOps camp starting with developer viewpoint and saying, this is stupid, we need to automate what we're doing, so we're going to get all these tools and automation and start doing infrastructure as code. But they're coming at it from an operations point of view, and they're going up to the developers and saying, look, we can make your lives easier, here's some tools to get things done. But they're really approaching the problem for two different sites. They sort of meet somewhere in the middle.
Interesting, isn't it? Now, another kind of AWS question to kind of follow along to that. We've been exchanging some emails before the show, and you made the comment, and I found it very fascinating that really, in a way, the industry has kind of flip-flopped slightly when it comes to feature sets. If you think about it, you had said, you know, public cloud in the beginning kind of missed a lot of the features or sophistication that data centers were kind of used to. But but the position really has, if you think about it, reversed a lot of times. If you look at a lot of the startups and solutions, they're trying to replicate AWS, so they're definitely following at this point. And then they don't necessarily have a lot of the authentication or VPC or a lot of these other things that you had spoken about. Of, it almost seems like everyone is chasing AWS at this point. Would you agree with that, and maybe expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that's something which I was just, you know, in my new role. So we have startups coming through, people that want funding. We see thousands of companies a year. That's kind of normal. And then maybe there's a few hundred that we think are particularly interesting, and then we fund a few tens of companies a year. So that's a typical VC pipeline. So the thousands, the hundreds, the tens. And what I started seeing as a pattern there was someone comes in and they're saying, you're going to build this wonderful system for automating and managing all of the authentication in your data center. And I sort of squint at it and says, looks like IAM to me. Yeah, okay. So are you compatible, or how does it relate to the AWS IAM? Oh, well, we don't care about that. We're just doing something like that for a data center, building it, and then their competitive analysis, they didn't include public cloud, right? And Google and Amazon and Azure all have very sophisticated identity and access management systems. And one of the problems that you have in the data center nowadays is that you get the sort of crunchy thing with a soft center. You know, once you get through the perimeter, you can roam around and do just about anything in most data centers. Maybe there's a few layers of firewall, but there's very large protection domains that you're getting through. Whereas if you look at a well-designed cloud-native architecture, you've got minimum privilege at every layer in it. You've got security groups saying that you can only talk to this machine on this port. Yeah, and there's no other way into it. It only supports that one thing, and you have to be coming from this place. So everything is incredibly locked down in a very fine-grained way. And you can, you know, that would be a complete pain in the neck to do manually. But because it's programmable infrastructure, you can create these very fine-grained, locked-down, minimum privilege systems, which is the basis for sort of good security hygiene. And then you get to key management, which is a pain in the neck to do right. But Amazon has just, you know, last year launched a key management service. So now there's a good practice ways of keeping your keys. So you can encrypt all your data at rest. You can encrypt all your communications. So you can build extremely secure, hardened systems. But it's, instead of being sort of a crunchy exterior with a soft interior, it's more like a sort of bag of marbles or something like that. It's each individual machine or instance is very hardened to get into. And if you get into one, it doesn't help you get into anything else. So it makes it it's a much better architecture for dealing with some of the sort of more widespread problems that we're seeing right now with security attacks and things like that. And people are trying to figure out how to implement things like that in the data center in some cases, but it's already been done. You end up copying things that are already there, like Amazon VPC is sort of, well, that sort of SDN is the software-defined networking is the data center version of that. But, you know, VPC and the Google equivalent of that are very powerful capabilities. You just program all of this networking stuff. So that's kind of what I was seeing.
Yeah. Now, as you see these companies come through, and you know they're all over the place, I mean, do you guys tend to have any kind of general guidelines that say, hey, if your business model is for example, this is just a kind of a random example, but you know, if your business model is, you know, trying to sell software into enterprises that want to build private data centers and private clouds, you sort of go, okay, we think the world's moved past that as a general theme. No, we're not interested. Or is do you, do you have to look at every single one of them, or like how do you sort through that many, you know, while you're keeping tabs on certain trends that are going on?
Let's say you're a startup and you're trying to sell into an enterprise. If you're trying to sell into the developer side of that enterprise, then typically you go out with an open source product. You try and build something that is viral in the developer community. And there's lots of good examples around now, things like Docker and whatever. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to sell into the CIO side of things, and you're typically, it's low friction. It's like, can I solve a developer problem in 30 seconds or a minute? And can they figure out what it does, download it, use it, it solves a problem in minutes. They go, yep, okay, I'm just going to keep using it. The other side, if you're trying to sell to the CIO, they have a different set of considerations. They're usually much more worried about trying to control the developers. So they're looking for things like policy automation, and they tend to want, they've been burnt so many times by having vendors vendor lock-in that they want multiple vendors. So they don't want the best solution, they want the most portable solution, whereas developers will typically go for the best solution. If you see what I mean. Like, no one would say, the best databases out there are Oracle and DB2, but I want a multiple vendor thing, so I'm going to make sure all my schemas are a generalized SQL that will always work on both Oracle and DB2. I don't think anyone ever did that. They picked one database. They went on it. And if you get the point I'm making here, but the developer architecture will pick best in breed for a particular problem that gets their solution out quickest.
Yep, makes sense. Absolutely. Now, change the subject just slightly, but still along the lines of it, when you're evaluating companies, tell us a little bit about something we were fascinated with, and we brought it up on the end of your show, was this idea of, you know, the trend towards open source and of course VC money and valuations of companies and how, you know, is there kind of a different valuation coming into play, or are we still thinking about it the same way, or is that something else that's, you know, kind of transitioning over time?
First of all, I don't generally do the financial valuation part of the VC world. I'm more of a technologist within the company rather than one of the partners on the financial side. But just to give you a little bit of perspective on that, I think that you get more value if you're a category leader, if you're a clear category leader, and to some extent, sort of Netflix is a category leader in its space, Docker is a category leader in its space, you know, MySQL, whatever. You get some extra valuation for just sort of market presence, right? So that has value regardless of whatever else is going on. So if you can get that first mover advantage and just dominate the discussion, become the generic word, to Dockerize something rather than people talking about containers, for example. So that's one example. The other thing is that you have to understand whether you're selling a product or selling a service. And I think a lot of people are just starting to understand how the difference in valuation and pricing models. Because for a service, it's usually recurring revenue. You're buying a subscription. And subscription-based businesses are very different to, I'm trying to sell, you know, just making money on the margin on selling you a product, because you're typically looking for customer lifetime value and the cost versus customer acquisition cost. And customers are unprofitable in the first few months, so they become profitable if you hold on to them for long enough. So that's in that model, you find SaaS products which are unprofitable. The faster they're growing, the more unprofitable they get, because they're acquiring lots and lots of unprofitable new customers. But as they mature, if their growth rate slows, they actually become more and more profitable. Right. So the question is, do you want more profits or more growth? And to some extent, you see that with Netflix. You see it with a lot of SaaS vendors. Roger Lee of Battery, the guy that runs the office I'm based in, just did a post about Box, where he was trying to explain to people why Box is unprofitable right now, but what it's doing is it's building up a flywheel of customers that will make it profitable in the future. So that's one model that to understand. And the valuation really comes down to how fast you can acquire new customers, because that's what gets you the market dominance, even though that makes you less unprofitable in the short term. So that, right. You know, the sort of profit margin-based valuations make sense if you're looking at standard retail with a markup kind of models, which is what sort of most the way most people think about companies.
Now, so get that. And yeah, I've seen some folks trying to do the box valuations and over time. Now, the strange thing about the open source companies and more companies kind of, you know, starting with an open source platform. So, I mean, you know, Docker is an easy example, but it could be Socketplane. It could be, you know, one of these OpenStack companies. I mean, it could be lots of them. They're a little bit different. So, like, for example, you know, because in essence, they're not selling a service per se. We've kind of debated Docker because it's easy and because of the amount of money they've gotten, you know, their valuation's a little higher. But we look at stuff like that and you say, who would I guess they could go IPO, but that feels like it's the only path that's kind of legitimate for them long term, because the trick is most of these companies that traditionally would have bought them, you know, an HP or a Cisco or a VMware or a whoever, don't really understand an open source business model. So for them, it's challenging. And then people go, well, you know, maybe a Google would buy them or an Amazon. You know the Amazon guys really well. You know, I'm just using Docker as an example. Those guys aren't in the business of acquiring raw technology. They tend to sort of acquire the people that understand it, and then they wrap process and automation and things around it, right?
I Amazon have bought very few companies. They tend to build it themselves. I think Netflix has never bought a company as well. It's a kind of, it's sort of culturally they don't want to have to deal with buying in a company. Mm-hmm. So I think the way to look at it is, if you're building an open source product, the way in through the developers is initially unprofitable because you're giving this thing away for free.
Sure.
And the question is, can you make it viral enough? Docker is viral because it solves a problem. It's easy to understand. It's got a good name and a good logo for figuring out what it does. And then everyone just starts using it. And at the time, it also, when it first came out, it was from a non-threatening source. So think about if exactly the same product had come out, but it had been released by IBM or VMware or somebody like that, everyone else would have gone, oh, we have to create the anti-Docker immediately, right? Because we don't want to have them take control. So there's some market dynamics that matter. So if you get in and you're non-threatening and you get in with a very viral product, suddenly it's everywhere. And then everyone adopts it. And then they look around and go, oh, everyone adopted it. It's kind of hard to back out now. It took a little while. I mean, you can kind of see the rocket thing is sort of the first attempt to build something. Well, okay, they got too far down the road. We want to back out a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a way in. Now, creating value out of that, I mean, you've got the growth rate is, in terms of number of downloads, is ridiculous. It's thousands of percent.
Right.
You see something go viral, and then you go, okay, how are they going to monetize it? Well, if you get in everywhere, then there's a few different ways of doing it, and there's several different categories of open source product. One big category is products that hold data, and I think companies will always buy service and support for software that's holding their data. So they will buy service for MySQL. They'll buy service for their name services. There's a whole bunch, like Mongo or Cassandra or whatever. There's all those kinds of things because they hold data. Whereas developer products, it's much harder to make money out of because developers just download and use and they can fix stuff and they're not critical. If you lose the data on a developer's laptop, it's not the end of the world, right? But you want you'll buy service for your local Git repository because it's your Git enterprise, whatever, because it matters, right? You don't want to lose or corrupt that data. So there's that sense of what are you putting in the system and how critical are the things you're doing. The other side of it is that I think is interesting is when you take a product like that and you somehow manage to surround it with SaaS-based services. So for Docker's point of view, that's the Docker Hub. And there's now certified products on the Docker Hub. You can get the official Nginx version of Nginx. You get the official certified Google platform that has Go in it or whatever, right?
Yep.
So you're building base components out of Docker Hub, which are, you can track through the provenance to the company that should own them and provide them. You can still put anything you want on there, but you can find the like the true sources, and you can build out of those components. I think that one opportunity Docker has, and this is very nascent and might not get there, but one possible way forward is to build something like a general-purpose enterprise app store, something that looks more like the Apple iOS app store. And there'd be a sort of a, how fast can you get apps into it? And if they need to add ways of doing billing for apps and things like that. But yeah, if you think of the way that people configure their mobile apps by downloading things from the App Store, maybe there's a general purpose place where you download an app from a Docker Hub, and it don't really mind whether you run it on, you know, AWS or Google or Azure or your own data center.
Right. Yep.
It's the same thing. Whereas right now, these app stores already exist. There's an Amazon app store. There's a Red Hat app store. There's a VMware one. There's a Chef one. I forget. They all have slightly different names, and they all have a few apps in them, but they don't have that. They're not general enough to really take off. You see what I mean? It's kind of like in the old day, there was sort of a Verizon app store that no one cared about, or your BlackBerry.
Right. Yep. That makes sense. Now, along those same lines, while we're kind of talking about Docker and kind of some of these other emerging technologies, if you will, for a second, to kind of go back to the predictions a bit, what's your take on adoption rates of kind of bleeding edge platforms? And you know, I saw the microservices presentation at Monktoberfest and at AWS. And so, you know, I've kind of been keeping up with your presentations lately. And, you know, by the way, for those out there, if you have a chance, go out to YouTube and check either of those out, because they're actually both out on YouTube. But so, like, where do you think we're going based off of some of the talks you've been doing recently?
Where are we going? So the speed of development is taking over in enterprise. So I think the most significant conference last year was the DevOps Enterprise Summit. If you go find that, there's a whole channel on YouTube, just worth studying some of those presentations, because they show really big, well-known brands that you think would be the sort of late adopters in some cases. It's just doing the DevOps root transformation, retooling their systems, and getting in amazing speed ups. Probably one of my favorites there is from Nordstrom. And the speaker from Nordstrom, she was talking about how they fundamentally switched their mindset in operations from optimizing for cost to optimizing for speed. And that really summarizes what's happening. People are figuring out that if you optimize for cost, for some reason, things don't get cheaper. But if you optimize for speed, you end up going so fast, I think you can't actually, don't get time to spend money, and it ends up costing less anyway, but that's actually a side effect of just trying to go faster. But in the meantime, the rate at which you deliver software goes up by maybe 100 times, releasing 100 times a quarter instead of once a quarter. Your defect rate typically drops by a factor of 10. So the number of failures in that quarter is one-tenth of what it was before. And the cost is something less, maybe half the cost, because you just get so much stuff done that you're not building wasted product and you're not wasting resources. You're getting stuff done so quickly that you get these little course corrections. And the whole agile model is sort of being taken to this next level where people are going much faster. And they're using, there's a DevOps transformation to get that to work right, because you basically have to build an API-driven platform underneath it to make it work. And I don't really care whether it's public or private. You know, AWS has a very functional public platform. You can go build your own private platform. The point is that you have to build a platform that's functional enough that it's API-driven, and it has to be big enough that it appears to be, you're not sort of keep running out of capacity in it. Just, yeah, that's, it should look infinite.
Do you find any common, you know, so as you're as you're either listening to those folks or talking to them afterwards, like, do you find any common patterns as to how they're making that transformation? You know, is it, hey, we get, you know, is it, because it's sort of easy to say, well, we've shifted our mindset from cost to speed. I mean, that's obviously, you know, culturally very hard. But I mean, like, beyond that first step, are you seeing anything newer or any new patterns as to why this is starting to take off and go faster? Is it just more people talking about it, more people to learn from, or is it some set of technology? Yeah. Or
I think there's a couple of things. One is that there's a few places where this is seeded in an organization, but the fundamental thing is that DevOps is a reorg, is my simple way of putting it. It takes about between 6 months to a year to do DevOps, and that's how long it takes to do a major reorg in a company. You've got to get everyone lined up. You've got to get everyone to understand what to do. You've got to actually mess with the org chart until you've actually merged together all these things in a very different way. Sort of almost like a 90-degree shift in the org chart, so that your teams are building these microservices and they have product manager through the delivery piece within each team, and they're operating very independently. So once you've built all these things out, everything's the first one you do is they were just flat disbelief from some of these big companies when they first tried doing this because the metrics were unbelievably good. It's like, what do you mean you were running orders of magnitude more efficiently? You know, how did really? You go and look at it. Well, it looks like it really did work. Okay, so let's try it again. Well, once they found the recipe for doing this, it spreads very virally because there's really no reason not to, and it makes them more competitive. But the place that it, I think, is there's a couple of places this is getting into enterprises. Just about every enterprise is having to deal with mobile, right? Mobile first. Anything you do, you've got some mobile apps. And the mobile teams have always been organized this way because they sort of turned up quickly. They had to iterate quickly. You had a product manager, some guys that knew how to write Objective-C, which no one else in the organization did. And then the deployment was done through the app store, so they didn't need to talk to ops, right? So you've got this platformization of a very microservice-like team, but the thing they're producing is an iPhone app or an Android app. And that, if you look at that model, it's probably stuck off on the side as a special case. But what's happening is you're saying, well, no, that's the norm. That should be your new normal case. Make everything look like that. Make the back-end services that app talks to behave like that and build all of your front-end things. And now the second one that's driving this is a lot of companies have Internet of Things stuff going on. You know, they've got things that they make, and they now have to have mobile apps configuring them via, you know, connectivity. So if you're doing that kind of transformation as well, you're having to build out new services that are much more connected than. And you're dealing with millions of things rather than dealing with a few thousand employees, maybe. So yeah. that's another one of those things that's changing the world for people.
Interesting. So I'm gonna sort of ask one last question because I think we're gonna kind of get to a longer show and all. So you know, we've talked a lot about kind of your view from a VC perspective and kind of your new view on things. You still, you know, you're still a hacker at heart. You're still a developer at heart. You were one of the first people that I knew that would walk around with the Google glasses and, you know, you used to talk about some of the little things that you were building and apps you were building. What's your take on, you know, wearables and sort of Internet of Things and the apps that are being built in that space?
I go back a fair way on that. So around about 2006, when I was at eBay, we built some mobile apps at eBay in the research lab, which nowadays would look sort of like an iPhone Android app, but in those days were just much too interactive and nothing like the normal phone-based apps. And that kind of got me into the idea of mobile development. I wanted to program what was in my pocket, but I was nothing to do it on in 2006, 2007. So a bunch of us in the Bay Area started the Homebrew Mobile Phone Club, and we started trying to build our own phone out of off-the-shelf chips. And I got interested in what these chips could do and the interfaces and sort of got into this futuristic mode. So in about 2008, I did some presentations about what the future of mobile might look like, and I included something that looks vaguely like glass. I also talked about ARM-based chips in the data center as well, which is sort of almost kind of happening, hasn't quite happened yet. And got a bit ahead of myself in a few places, but I was sort of fascinated by and thinking in those days about what you could do with this. And this was a side project. It was actually nothing to do with my day job. It was just me sort of rambling in public. And sort of when Glass actually came out, I went, okay, I just want one, right?
Yeah.
I figured out what it is, and what I found is, you know, kids are fascinated by it. Most young people, sort of call the Facebook generation or whatever, don't have any problem with it. The older people are more fussed about, why are you looking at me with that thing stuck on your face, you know? So there's definitely a generational divide there from the sort of personal privacy point of thing. I think Glass, I was hoping last year they'd actually do a product launch and get it out. And I think they ran into a two or three issues, fundamental issues. One is, I think I read somewhere that their hardware supplier was Motorola, and that chipset that they were on basically dead-ended. And they've jumped chipset, and they've got to deal with Intel, and that new thing hasn't come out yet. So I think they've had to rebuild their hardware around a chipset that's got a longer future path on it. And so we'll see if they get that right this time around. The other one is the software. And my problem with it was it never quite solved my problem. There's two aspects to that. One is I'm an iOS user on my phone. I've tried Android. I don't really like it. But it's really a very Android-focused device. So it doesn't integrate well into the iOS space. That made it hard to use for me. The other thing is that it doesn't really understand the difference between home and work. And there are, I have two email accounts, and I have a calendar. I sort of have more than one calendar, really, but mostly I use my work calendar to record everything. And Glass was looking in my home calendar, which had nothing in it, my Gmail calendar, if you like, and found nothing there. So all this sort of things it would be trying to optimize for you, it would only see a small fraction of what I was doing. So a lot of the integration with my life just didn't work right. They never had a thing in it where you said, this is your work. When you go home, switch to home. I think they need something there, or products in this space need to understand that people have different modes of working for something that you'd be wearing all day. So that's it just seems that they missed the product spec a little bit in that sense. But anyway, I'd still use it mostly for recording. I use it as basically a head-mounted GoPro for recording videos. That's basically it. And I'm hoping that they figure out their issues and make it a better product going forward.
Yeah. And are you generally bullish on kind of where wearables and sort of personal devices are going? Or, you know, do you still have that, I'm going to look 5 or 6 years into the future and I see something, you know, radically different?
I'm very happy the iPhone came out like it did. My homebrew mobile phone thing is still sitting in a bag at home. The iPhone came out. I paid $100 for the developer license, started writing apps, and went, okay, I can do this. Fine. I can now program what's in my pocket. And then everyone else programmed it, so I didn't have to because the apps are just there for everything I wanted. So that's been fun. I've been hacking around a little bit. I did, by the way, try out the Android Wear watches and for a week or two, and I never really could figure out how to use them well enough to make it really comfortable. So I think that those are missing the mark for me. I'm interested to see if the Apple Watch does a better job of integrating and working well with the way I operate. So that I'm going to try that out. On the other side, most of my programming now, in the last year, one of the things I've said is that I see a lot of things written in Go. And I've basically, in the last year, I spent a week or so, learned Go, got very comfortable with it. So actually, it doesn't take very long to become I think, a fairly effective Go programmer. I feel comfortable in the language, right? And so I've been tinkering around. There's some stuff on GitHub I've built. And some of the talks I'm going to be giving in 2015, I'm going to be talking more about the code I've written in Go, because it's a sort of a simulator for microservices based on some things I built ages ago. And really sort of nanoservices, if you like, where little Go routines are individual that are structured as services in themselves. So.
Oh, yeah. I think I heard you. There was a talk on maybe the new stack that someone had, they recorded you. I think you were talking about this simulator for services. So, yeah, that'll be something to kind of keep an eye on. Now, is that kind of the same premises like the AWS Lambda stuff, or is it completely different?
No, this is something I can run on my laptop that I can run 100,000 node simulation on, and build something that looks sort of roughly the same complexity as Netflix, but run it on my laptop and be able to try and visualize it and understand it, the behavior of it. Some of this ties in. So there's the version of this that is running on the code that I've dreamt up in my head that I haven't written yet is wonderful. It does all these wondrous things.
It's like my PowerPoint slides.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah. So I have all these great ideas. I'm relatively slowly trying to get that code written. I always have yet another presentation I have to write. At the moment, I'm trying to finish writing the foreword for the In Search of Certainty, Mark Burgess's second edition. He asked me to write a foreword for it, and I've written about half of it, and that's actually the thing that's bugging me I'm supposed to be doing, that's preventing me from coding. And then I can write some promise theory into my simulator and try and get my head around that. So that's my techie, geeky stuff that I'm continuing with in between talking to all these interesting companies.
That's cool. All right. Well, I guess we're going to wrap it up from there. So Adrian, for those that aren't already following you, where can everyone kind of find out what you've got going on, follow you, what kind of upcoming speaking do you have, things like that?
Sure. So on Twitter, I'm at Adrian Co, Adrian Co. I have a blog at perfcap.blogspot.com. That's back in 10 years ago when I started, it was performance capacity planning is what I was thinking about. Lots of stuff on there. Battery Ventures is at battery.com. And there's a Powered by Battery, sort of a official blog there where I have some posts there. Where am I going to be? I do two kinds of things. So just to summarize what I did last year, I did about 40 public conferences last year, and almost 30 internal presentations at companies, plus some blog, you know, other stuff. So I'm doing a few of those kinds of things every now and again. The next place I'm going to be, there's a performance conference in Austin at the beginning of February. It's an IEEE ACM performance engineering conference. And then there's a conference in Berlin called Micro Exchange. That's my next month or two. And then there's the O'Reilly Software Architecture Conference in Boston in March. So that's my activities in Q1, I guess, public ones anyway.
Fantastic. And yes, again, as a reminder, if you want to catch up on the recent presentations, I would definitely, again, recommend the AWS conference presentation that you did, as well as the Monktoberfest presentation.
Yeah, they're very different presentations. The AWS one, I'm trying to go and look at more about cost optimization, because everyone wants to be faster and cheaper. So I've been talking about speed of development for a long time, and then I started trying to talk about how to optimize the cost of running things.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everyone. If you like the show, please tell a friend and leave us a review on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at thecloudcastnet or on the web at thecloudcast.net, where you can find links to everything Cloudcast. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks, sir.
Right about now, you're asking yourself, why isn't the rest of the show done with a female English accent? You love it, don't you? You want to hear more, don't you? Hit subscribe.